Hello, this is Earl Fontenelle. This is the Schwepp Secret History of Western Esotericism podcast. Today we're speaking with Christa Muratore, doctoral candidate and lecturer in the English department at University of Illinois in Chicago, working on the twin topics of the Antichrist and counterculture. An interesting kind of pairing. Mm-hmm. Christa, thanks so much for coming on the Schwepp.
Yeah, thanks for having me here.
So, tell me about the Antichrist and counterculture. What are you working on?
What I'm working on currently with my dissertation is thinking about countercultural apocalypses, and I'm very interested in the way in which apocalyptic authors such as William Blake, such as folks in the 20th century, kind of draw upon kind of a rich tradition of Christian mysticism and apocalypse to create these texts that are very interested in our place in history, how we think about crisis, but are also interested in kind of the future, how we make a better society, how we create a world that's amenable for imagination and kind of creative possibilities. And for me, as I've been doing research on this project, I feel like a big part of that is, you know, the role of the Antichrist in apocalypse. And to kind of just sum it up super quickly, I'm very interested in the way that the Antichrist in apocalypse kind of stands for a lot of kind of anxieties about Christian history, about the way that it knows what it knows, and like, yeah, how it kind of tells stories about itself, especially through theatricality, through performance. Antichrist becomes a way of kind of thinking about the limits of the current moment, about kind of the unsustainability of, you know, our current time, whether that's our current time in 2026 or, you know, William Blake's time at the turn of the 19th century, or, you know, even thinking back to, you know, folks like Pseudo-Methodius or Adsel.
So the thing I wanted, the only boring methodological thing I wanted to take up with you is this idea of counterculture, because it's something everyone has a kind of intuitive idea of what a counterculture is. Most people think of the 1960s, I think, or at least if they're old enough to have been in the ambit of that culturally, they think of, the 60s, counterculture. Yes, we know what that is. It's the hippies, it's flower power, da-da-da. But actually, what is a counterculture? It's a little bit difficult to, it's more difficult to pin down than people might think. How are you framing it? What is a counterculture?
Yeah, that's something I've definitely, early on in working on my dissertation, something that my committee kind of pushed me to think about is, yeah, how are you defining counterculture? How are you defining apocalypse? I think that counterculture is a really, in a lot of productive ways, a very slippery term, but to kind of give a sense of where I'm coming from with it, I'm very influenced by Theodore Rossick's, I think I'm pronouncing his name right, his book Making of a Counterculture, where he thinks of kind of the 60s counterculture as being opposed primarily to what he calls technocracy. Like, basically, he's thinking about a disciplinary society that's all about making a profit by any means possible and kind of organizing society and culture to maximize profit, even to the extent of kind of incorporating what seem like dissident elements to kind of create a smoothly functioning society. And he talks a lot about how 60s counterculture is kind of, you know, opposed to kind of, he calls it the total ethos of the atomic bomb. Basically, like this idea that a specialized military industrial society can create this like weapon that can just wipe out hundreds of thousands or millions of people. So I think like that idea of counterculture as an attempt to kind of push against technocracy, I think that's really valuable for thinking about the history of counterculture in modernity. And by again, that's another term that's like very methodologically thought, but here I'm using it to mean the period my dissertation kind of covers from the 1650s with some delightful folks known as the Ranters, who are, you know, in the English Civil War. They're people who kind of come up in that chaos and are like, why do we need laws? Why do we need a church in order to be Christopher Hill, who's a wonderful historian, writes a lot about them. And he kind of compares them to the 60s counterculture. And I think Blake is definitely part of that kind of opposition to a technocracy and opposition to, you know, what ends up becoming industrial capitalism by the 19th century and kind of takes on its really ugly global genocidal form during World War II. So yeah, that's kind of my working definition of counterculture, is kind of an attempt to oppose this technocracy. And I think that definition is useful because you can think about left-wing countercultures, you can think about right-wing countercultures, you can think about kind of how counterculture, I think we often with the 60s, we want to think that counterculture, you know, there's that one quote, that counterculture died with like Charles Manson and the Sharon Tate murders. Like, and I don't think that's true. There was a very rich countercultural tradition in both the UK and America in the 70s, even in the 80s. And yeah, I think thinking about counterculture as an attempt to kind of dismantle and disrupt technocracy allows us to kind of appreciate it in a lot of its different forms, its different like guises.
So to historicize that, you can, when you describe Blake there, it's on the nose, right? Dark satanic mills, we don't like them. We're Republican rather than monarchist. We're very interested in, even if we're not a member, we're not, Blake's not a joiner, but he's very much of that free-thinking, dissenting tradition in British Christianity. But a tradition that were indeed being chucked in jail quite regularly at the time, the Quakers, the Ranters, etc. Strong, radical kind of political activism pedigree there, right? But using technocracy as the foil for counterculture, that means at a certain point, going back in time, we're not going to really have counterculture in this sense, because there wouldn't really be something, there wouldn't be a technocracy, or would there?
I think counterculture definitely looks very, I will admit that before the 13th century, I get a little fuzzy, but I do like Bernard McGinn's idea that, I'm definitely going to butcher his name, but with Joachim of Fior, we kind of get, because Bernard McGinn, you know, he makes a really interesting argument that often apocalypse is kind of, we think of apocalypse as kind of, or I think many people kind of outside of a community that's very familiar with Christian mysticism thinks of apocalypse as kind of this radical revolutionary genre. They think of like William Blake's very like explicit revolutionary poems, and they're like, oh, apocalypse is automatically this subversive tradition, or the Apocalypse of St. John is like, you know, an anti-Roman text, which is definitely a controversial opinion. There's a lot of debate about that, but McGinn makes the argument that apocalypse is often used to kind of shore up the status quo, and that's not until Joachim of Fior, and then you get people like Jan Hus and Munster who come along and are thinking about like the papal antichrist, with thinking about the idea that the church is kind of the body of Christ and it could become diseased by the antichrist and we need to remove that. Then apocalypse kind of becomes amenable to, yeah, thinking against the mainstream, thinking against kind of the current hegemonic power. For my project, I kind of like orienting it in terms of kind of this emerging technocratic power, because I feel like it puts it in much more concrete historical terms. Something I'm trying to work on is thinking of a way of thinking about apocalypse that's historically grounded, but also, yeah, historically grounded, but thinks of it as a continuum, as a tradition, something where people are borrowing from these tropes and ideas and using them to kind of speak to their moment. Because there's definitely a Marxist strain of anti-apocalyptic criticism, which I'm kind of pushing against, that's like, oh, apocalypse gets rid of history, it's all about preserving the status quo, and we need to do away with apocalypse, we need to get rid of apocalypse in criticism. That's kind of the naysayer, if you will, that I'm pushing against in my own project. So yeah, I definitely think that I think any definition of counterculture is going to be polemical. You're basically trying to push some kind of agenda, even in defining counterculture, because you're setting up boundaries between what is the mainstream hegemonic culture and what is the alternative to that. But I do think that the basis of what I'm doing could hopefully be transposed to earlier epochs, hopefully.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's an interesting one to, if you think about the whole scope of historical Christianity, because I think it is, in its early moments, it's early, say, two centuries, three centuries, well, until the Council of Nicaea, really, if it's not anti-Roman simply because you can't generalize that much and say it's anti-Roman,
of course,
certainly a social ferment that's doing a lot of critiquing of the Roman social order. Like, slaves welcome, women welcome, feed the poor.
Right.
Don't abandon victims of plague, help them out. Like, all this stuff is very non-Roman, and the Romans were not comfortable with it, right? Until it becomes the state cult.
Right.
And then suddenly, you've got Constantine breathing down your neck, or later on, you've got Justinian breathing down your neck, saying, I hope you subscribe to all these definitions we've come up with, because otherwise, you mean trouble.
Right.
And then that maybe is the, not if not the technocracy, that's the ocracy that is suddenly, you might need a counterculture within Christianity or without it to push back against that, right?
Absolutely.
And if you put yourself in the position of an early Christian watching the state structure crystallize across the Roman Empire, you'd be like, no, right? It's like the revolution's been co-opted.
Yeah, I definitely think that there's an interesting way which, like, I feel like what you're saying rhymes kind of, yeah, it rhymes well with what I was saying, in that there feels like there's a way in which, like, early Christian counterculture is resisting this disciplinary push, this standardization.
Yeah.
If you will, and you see that in all, like, I was raised Mormon, and you see, like,
whoa.
I know, really wild stuff. You see in, like, the history of Mormonism in the 20th century that suddenly the people in charge are like, okay, we gotta kind of whitewash and, like, clean up the religion and make it so that we're all on the same page, and we're not saying, like, the Roman Catholic Church is the Antichrist or black people can't have the priesthood. It would be interesting to study how that resistance to disciplinary standardization takes place in, like,
well, in Mormonism, it takes place in the formation of countless sects, right?
Yes.
There's millions of groups of Mormons scattered across the U.S. and elsewhere who just split off and went, no, you're not, you know, we don't follow Brigham Young, we're staying here, and then the next lot break off, and then the next lot try to break off and get slaughtered, and then, you know, there's all these kind of breakaway movements. Zionist Mormons.
Oh, absolutely. It gets crazy. Like, I did my undergrad in Utah, and you would, like, hear people talk about, like, the fundamentalist Latter-day Saints, like the ones who still practice polygamy, the Church of Christ, who's like, oh, Brigham Young doesn't know what he's doing, and, like, we have to follow Joseph Smith III. It's unfortunate that the Mormon mainstream church in Utah kind of didn't let people kind of explore this kind of rich history, because I feel like there is a, as someone who is no longer Mormon, I think there is a way you can learn about that and, like, you know, kind of find your faith through that, understanding kind of the history of all these schisms and attempts to kind of rein in this kind of freedom of expression that happens in any forming kind of new religion or organization.
Yeah, it's in a way the Arc of Mormonism, you could see it as a very compressed retelling of the same story of the Arc of Christianity, just in a much shorter time. Radical, they actually have to flee American society because it's not on the path of God, right? So they go out into the wilderness and form a theocratic city-state out in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
And that's a pretty radical and countercultural thing to do, you might say. Right? Intentional.
Absolutely.
Community out in the middle of nowhere, militant, very active, they're printing a newspaper, they're building like crazy, they're doing all that stuff. But now when you think of Mormons, not that much later, right? They are pillars of white bread American, sort of what they like to call conservatism in this country.
Absolutely,
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Which is about as non-countercultural as you can get, it seems to me.
Yeah.
Even though they still believe in this very, on the face of it, odd, esoteric offshoot of Christianity. It's like an unpromising place to find the absolutely staunch white bread American middle of the road conservative movement, but that is where you find it, right?
Yeah, that's always been something that's like, it was probably one of the reasons I left the Mormon Church, but it's also like why I find it so fascinating. Just this absolute disconnect between kind of its radical roots and how it's kind of ingratiated itself into this, as you said, like very white bread kind of American kind of conservative fantasy. Like, I find that really interesting. And yeah, that's, I think, a great illustration of, I think we often think of counterculture as, like, losing its groove, as getting co-opted by, like, the mainstream. But there is a way in which strains of counterculture kind of persist in kind of the mainstream and then come back in kind of these uncanny, weird forms, as you said, with all the Mormon offshoots. I remember living in Utah, people, you know, there was definitely a vocal minority of, you know, Mormon white nationalists. And, like, yeah, you definitely, it's interesting to see how those things continue and crop up. Yeah, and in that case, like, yeah, it's a little terrifying, but I think still worth thinking about.
Yeah, maybe the apocalyptic genre, and the Apocalypse of John in particular, functions in Christianity. This maybe brings us to our proper subject of conversation. Functions in Christianity as the kind of leaven for occasional explosions of counterculture, because it's evoking the end times. It's evoking, well, first of all, it's just esoteric, and so the doors of interpretation are just wide open.
Absolutely.
If you're trying to make sense of this thing, you got to start coming up with some ideas about what it means. And so what it means might be that in the Revelation of John, this figure called the Antichrist is going to arise in the last days. The thing that's interesting about the Antichrist, to me anyway, is that he is going to be kind of a really great guy.
Yes.
He's not some kind of satanic, horrible, flaming, smelly demon character. He's like a smooth-talking, he's going to convince everyone. He's like, he's going to be this sort of universal leader figure, right?
Yes.
But that's why he's bad.
Yeah, I think that brings up, like, one of the things that got me interested in, like, Antichrist and its role in countercultural apocalypse, because, you know, have you seen the Omen movies?
Yeah.
Have you seen the Final Conflict with Sam Neill? It's like when
Damien becomes the president, is that right?
Well, he becomes like the ambassador to Britain, so he can like murder the Christ child, and like, it's a bonker. I love the Final Conflict. I think it's a great movie. I also have like such a soft spot for Christian scare films, because I like Sam Neill. He's just like a fantastic scenery chewing actor. But like, it's funny because you watch it and you're like, he doesn't seem that bad. He's promoting like healthy youth counterculture. His involvement in the Middle East seems much more educated than, you know, the character of the president in the movie. He's like, it's hard to tell if it's ironic or not, but he's weirdly okay with queer people in the movie. He's okay with soy substitutes, and you're like, this guy seems pretty chill. And then, like, of course, they have to make him this horrendous infanticidal maniac in the last 20 minutes of the movie. That movie famously ends with, you know, Christ just coming at the last minute, killing the Sam Neill Antichrist character, and then there are Bible verses on the screen. What's funny, though, is that everyone trying to kill the Antichrist in that movie, with the exception of two characters, all get killed. You know, the love interest of the Antichrist, her son gets killed, and that's how she's able to kill the Antichrist, is through that kind of sacrifice. So it's a very kind of, you get to the end and you're like, was it worth it? Was it worth getting rid of Antichrist character? And I find that in a lot of Antichrist media, as you said, like, you definitely get this sense that, yeah, what makes him problematic is the fact that he's kind of imitating these Christian values of goodness. There's that wonderful passage in Hippolytus, where Hippolytus is like comparing the Antichrist to partridge singing and like leading other bird children, their chicks, away from the mother, and then like the chicks hear their real mother's voice and come back to her. So there's this way in which Antichrist represents like artifice and like imitation, creating like duplicates, and not only duplicates of goodness and virtue and morality that look good, but are incredibly convincing. That's one of the exciting things I find about like reading and watching media with the Antichrist, is that the Antichrist is so convincing, so good at seeming like a good person. You know, there's that line you see all the time in apocalyptic literature, like, even the righteous are convinced. Even those with firm faith are like, oh, maybe this is the second coming of Christ. Like, it certainly seems more politically motivated than the first Christ. There certainly seems more interested in immediate social reform. There's an interesting way in which you read and watch a lot of 20th century Antichrist media, a lot of it which is very conservative, and you're like, Antichrist seems like rooting for the right things. I don't see what the problem with this fella is. But,
I don't know. This reminds me of Paradise Lost. For the whole poem, Satan is clearly the hero.
Yes.
Right? It doesn't matter if you're a Christian reader. You cannot read this poem and not love the figure of Satan. even if it's just admiring his tragic downfall and refusal to bow, even at the price of his existence. And then right at the end, God comes and turns him into a snake, and he's all pathetic. And it's like, yeah, but I'm not convinced by that! You know, he was... So it's a bit like in The Final Conflict, you know, the Antichrist is fantastic until right at the end they have to make him satanic and evil. But basically, yes. He was, for the majority of the piece, he was the good guy, right?
Yeah, at least with Paradise Lost, like, Satan kind of declined. Like, he's this very conflicted, fully fleshed out character, and then by the time he's, like... spoilers. By the time he's convincing Eve to eat the fruit in Book 9, he's like this cartoonish, I've heard it described, like this like mustache twirling like villain. He's still very delightful. Like, Satan is one of the most compelling, fun characters, even when he's at his lowest, even when he's at kind of his most degraded. And that's been something I've been thinking a lot about too, because I feel like a lot of apocalyptic texts, especially Pseudo-Methodius, they kind of abruptly end with the conquest of Antichrist. The only exception I can think of is this bizarre... Have you heard of the Musipoli?
No.
It's like this bizarre German poem. It's early, like the 8th or 9th century. There's a lot of debate about how to properly translate it. But like very early in this like 150-line poem, around the 50th line or so, Antichrist is defeated. And then it's just, the description of apocalypse kind of still goes on. And I feel like that's very unusual, because usually Antichrist is defeated, and that is when Christ comes. That's when, as with The Final Conflict, you get those Bible verses on the screen, and that's kind of the end of history. That's the end of the narrative. And there's an interesting way which I feel like Antichrist indexes or alerts us to the limit of our current moment. The fact that how things are in the present, going back to this idea of technocracy in the case of a modern understanding or a kind of a disciplinary society when we were more in general, Antichrist feels like it's saying, this can't go on. This kind of current state of things can't go on. It's kind of the limit of the present, if you will. And yeah, that's why these texts have to kind of abruptly end, I feel like, because it's so hard to think of an alternative. Like, it's so hard to think of a future outside of these kind of demonic presence, like, as I call them in my work.
Right. Demonic presence. To take that to a non-theological register, you know, someone said it's easier for people to imagine, words to the effect of, it's easier for people to imagine nuclear annihilation than an end of capitalism.
Right, yeah, I think Mark Fisher borrowed that from Frederick Jameson.
Okay,
yeah.
Wow, cool. We have a provenance. This is blatantly true.
Yes.
Right? We can all imagine a nuclear catastrophe, and in fact, it's been becoming more likely in recent decades, precisely at the time when people have been putting it out of their minds. You know, our parents' generation grew up under the shadow of, you know, this might be imminent, we're preparing
absolutely
for it. No one really talks, my kids don't really talk about nuclear annihilation, but it is more, empirically, much more likely now than ever before, or that's what they tell us, right? Mm-hmm. But everyone can get their head around what it involves to some degree. It's just absolute destruction, basically.
Yes.
But what a sustainable alternative to the current world order, the world economic political order, would look like. I mean, you can read science fiction novels and get different, you know, pictures of it, but no one can really get their head around that.
No, not at all. That's kind of something I'm struggling with this dissertation. It's not even like the most brilliant countercultural figures can really... That same guy, Frederick Jameson, he talks about this idea of like a utopian like impulse, basically like thinking of a better future. And I think that's like a really useful way of thinking about apocalypse and how that's kind of in tension with, when I use the term like demonic, it definitely like refers to like, you know, the common theological notion of hellfire and brimstone. It's also like borrowing from this dude, Northrop Frye, who's like talks about how like the opposite of kind of this utopian horizon or idea is the demonic, right? Basically the present, as you were talking about Blake and his dark satanic mills, like that's a perfect encapsulation. Think of like AI slop and think of sweatshops and all of that. Like, I think there's like too much to list, and I feel like we're all pretty familiar with it regardless of where you are politically. I think we all complain about the like gas prices, for example, these wars that have very slippery objectives that seem like they don't have much to do with us. Like, I think, yeah, that's kind of, it so informs how we, like, think about the world. That's so hard to step outside of that. It's impossible. So I think we're constantly toggling between this kind of what is possible, what's going on in the present, and this idea of impossibility. I think that's what Apocalypse is doing. That's really exciting. And I think Antichrist is important for understanding an aspect of that, moving back and forth between the terrible place we're in right now and a place that could be better, maybe.
Before we talk about Blake, which I definitely want to do, let's talk about Jacob Boehme, the great Teutonic philosopher. What use does Boehme make of the figure of Antichrist?
Well, yeah, and I think it's Mystericum Pansophicum. Like, he talks about how there are kind of these two forces. He talks about how there is a will based in spiritual knowledge that's based in kind of what he calls the language of God. And then you have this kind of natural will, this kind of fallen will that he like associates with Babel and the Antichrist. Very similar to Origen, who talks about how these, and I think Augustine also says this to an extent, but it's a little more, yeah, it's a little, Origen definitely waffles a little bit from what I understand. And the idea that Antichrist is something is more of this kind of force, is this force of a fallen, yeah, non-spiritual, very avarice-driven society. What I think Boehme does as exciting is that he says that in kind of the fallen world we're in, you need these two forces, that this force of light can't really, or in spiritual knowledge, can't really manifest itself without this kind of dark, fallen force. He's very interested in alchemy. He's very interested in this idea of a dialectic, this idea that you have two things that kind of interact with each other, and in their interaction, they kind of create this process. I don't like the idea of dialectic, you know, creating like just like a synthesis that's just a product. It's kind of this process that keeps on going. That
the
keeps
light
on.
And the darkness are just always there.
Yeah, and they're driving. Just always producing kind of this new kind of esoteric knowledge about the world. And I think that's hugely influential on Blake. Boehme's very difficult. I mean, when I like first read the Mysterium Magicum, I was like, what is going on? Like, he's just throwing all these alchemical terms at you, and you're just like, okay, like, sure, flag rat? What? I don't know what that means, but whatever. But, like, it is fascinating that even in, like, the 20th century, some of the scholars I'm very interested in are quoting Boehme and being like, hey, Boehme can be inspirational to a 20th century counterculture. You have, like, Norman O'Brown, this American guy who, like, very much spoke to kind of 60s, like, counterculture on, like, the West Coast, I think, especially. And he's quoting Boehme, he's quoting Blake, like, as he's calling for this kind of constant revolution, which I think is very much in line with kind of this constant struggle between light and dark.
Yeah. So is it right to say that Boehme totally internalizes the apocalyptic moment, or does he also have a kind of exoteric historical reading of the process of history where, you know, Christ is literally going to come back and the time is literally going to end, as well as this sort of internal thing?
I definitely get the sense that for him it is both kind of an internal and kind of an external process. And that is very interesting because, you know, you read a lot of historians of apocalypse like Christopher Hill or Bernard McGinn who are like, oh, the problem with kind of modern apocalypse is it becomes too internalized. The problem with like the Antichrist is this like, you know, Augustinian dark force in yourself that you have to confront is that you can no longer use Antichrist to critique the papacy, to critique government. I think because Boehme comes from an alchemical background, he's really interested in this idea of microcosm and macrocosm, the fact that like big things are reflected by these little events or processes in Mysterium Magicum. He's always talking about the life of Christ and the passion of Christ. It's kind of these ways of thinking about history, these ways of thinking about kind of the spiritual development of the alchemist. I think Blake does that too. These internal struggles he feels as an artist caught between the present and the future, he kind of explodes those so that they suddenly become the concerns of, you know, a Europe racked by the Napoleonic War. There's a way in which this boundary between like the individual and kind of a more global collective, like, becomes much more porous. And I think we start to get that with, like, mystics, like,
or Burma. Isn't, maybe, it's not that it becomes more porous, it's that we as early 21st century interpreters are so conditioned to think about individual versus collective as two totally different realms that we have split up what for those guys was naturally not split in the first place, right? So that the inner drama of salvation would be some kind of microcosm of the macrocosmic cycle of history in which Christ will return and redeem humanity and reality.
Absolutely. Know? Yeah, no, I really like that way of putting it. Like, I think that's something that Blake is very interested in, is how, like, in our kind of, he argues that kind of the course of modernity from, like, the 16th, 17th century on is towards splitting this, what he calls selfhood, like kind of the isolated individual from a sense of responsibility to the community, responsibility to everyone else, when these things, he argues, shouldn't be. Like, we shouldn't have to tear them apart from each other. Mm. I find that as a big problem in a lot of criticism in general, that is that it feels like it either has to focus on kind of the local scale, or it has to focus on big global issues and kind of ignore what's going on in a city or in a town between people. I think that's, I think that's a thing I find really cool about someone like Blake, is that, as you said, he's kind of mapping, like, these personal struggles and these cycles of history, like, simultaneously together, so that they, like, bleed into each other. You can't really, that's what makes Blake, like, so fun, but also so frustrating, is you can't really disentangle Blake the poet or his stand, what many people consider his stand-in in the poetry Los, can't really disentangle that from his political messaging, from his kind of ideas about, like, sexuality and the role of a writer in society. Like, it's very hard to disentangle, I guess, the narrative from kind of what he's trying to say as kind of a more, like, cultural or political thinker.
Yeah, and I guess this does bring us into the realm of that nebulous and hard to define thing, Christian mysticism. Mm-hmm. The idea that, I mean, let's take Blake. The ancient Hebrew prophets are, for him, he doesn't have the same question as, an Origen or another early Christian thinker as to what exactly is the status of these early prophets who came before Christ, you know? Mm-hmm. It's like, well, I talked to them.
Right.
Like, I don't need to ask about Moses' status. He appeared to me yesterday around tea time and we discussed the artist's role or whatever.
Yeah.
So he's living among these, this whole panoply of sacred figures from sacred history, Hebrew prophets, angels, Jesus, you name it. But I feel like that is very typically Christian mystical. Not all Christian mysticism. So, for example, we don't find anything like that in the Pseudo-Dionysius.
You're
but
right.
We very much find it in medieval visionary texts.
Absolutely. You know?
At least a couple angels are going to come and talk to you, if nothing, not more, you know, personages. So this idea of the ancients not being dead, but just being sort of normally invisible, but if you're the right sort of person or you do the right practices, you can talk to them. That's very traditional. And I feel like Blake is just plugging into that tradition. Maybe in a way that's sort of out of time. Like he's sort of doing what medieval people were doing in an era when a lot of the people around him are done with that stuff.
Yeah, I'm really glad you brought that up, because you're right. Like, Blake is definitely not, he's not, like, kind of reinventing the wheel. He's very much treading in shoes that the Ranters walked in, that, like, poet like Christopher Smart walked in, and even earlier, someone like, are you familiar with Marjorie Kemp at all?
Yeah.
Like, yeah, wonderful, bonkers woman who would, you know, talk about these kind of direct vision, like, very immediate visions she has of, like, Christ suffering and Christ speaking to her, even Christ, you know, having a very intimate sensual relationship. I think that's a really good thing to bring up. Part of the title of my dissertation is, you know, A Long History of Counterculture and a Lingering Apocalyptic. I'm really interested in this idea of how these traditional mystical ideas kind of linger and then get applied to new historical traditions. And because obviously Marjorie Kemp, living in, you know, 14th century England wasn't dealing with kind of a rising industrial empire. And she's very disinterested in the world around her. She's very interested in kind of this interior experience. But, you know, with the English Civil War, with the ranters, with people like the Fifth Monarchist, and, you know, they definitely have their fair share of, in that time from the 1630s to the 1660s, a lot of great, like, women mystics claiming kind of immediate experiences with ancient prophecy. Eleanor Davies is a wonderful one, really hard to understand, but really great. Anna Trapnell as well. So it's interesting to see how these ideas kind of linger. Part of the reason I started this dissertation was because I was fascinated by the way in which William Blake, who for many people is this curmudgeonly, very grumpy kind of guy, as you said, out of step with his time, very much. There's this wonderful Northrop Frye quote where he says that Blake is, I'm paraphrasing, but he's basically a child of the Renaissance who's stuck in this kind of Augustan 18th century time frame, and that's why he seems so weird, is because he's trying to do this bonkers mystical stuff while people like Alexander Pope and like Thomas Gray are still like the big influences. And it's interesting how William Blake is still speaking to, you see him even like the Making of a Counterculture book I mentioned earlier, Blake is the epigraph for that book. Blake is quoted by Norman O'Brown. He's a huge influence on a lot of avant-garde filmmakers. So it's interesting how this medieval mystical tradition, I think there's a very surface level reading where like mysticism kind of gets displaced by secularism, it gets displaced by scientific way of looking at the world. But no, I think you look at folks like Blake and you see this kind of continuation of this tradition. And what's unique and interesting is how people are using this tradition to say things that their predecessors couldn't have or wouldn't have been able to.
And that brings us maybe to technology, which is something you're very interested in, I know. I mean, Blake was an innovator in his chosen craft, that of the printer, and did these sort of avant-garde illuminated books, but they were printed, so he could sort of, on a workshop scale, mass-produce them, but they were all different because he was laying on the pigments as the spirit moved him, so each one is an individual, one-of-a-kind piece. And they are, as far as he's concerned, prophetic works. So this is how Elijah presumably would have published his prophecies if he had lived in the 1790s, you know? So the relationship between apocalypse and technology, I don't know. One of the things we talked about is the current cultural freakout is this dude, Peter Thiel, who is a tech oligarch, and I guess he's a Catholic?
Yeah.
Anyway, he has very theological ideas about his own importance and the importance of what he's doing. So the natural thing to say would be, okay, well, this guy is either the Antichrist or working for the Antichrist, right? He's talking about the great technological future that's going to transform everyone's life, and it's going to be so great and fantastic and freedom and all this, these sort of buzzwords that we like.
Right.
But no, says Peter Thiel, actually, so you'd say, yeah, this obvious candidate for antichristhood, but no, the antichrist is anyone who gets in his way.
Right? Yes, Greta Thunberg, or maybe Bill Gates. So there's a great Guardian article about, like, where someone, like, sent the Guardian a transcript of Peter Thiel's lectures, and they basically just, like, paraphrase a quote, like, large portions. No, reading it, you're like, this feels like something the antichrist would say. And it is very interesting because I do feel like Peter Thiel is a very heterodox Catholic. He's clearly read his fair share of Apocalypse. I think I was looking a little bit, and in a lot of podcasts like that he appears on, he always reference Soloviev, I think is how you pronounce it, who wrote this short story called A Short Story of the Antichrist, which is basically about, it's a hard story to recommend. It's starts off very racist. Basically, the people of Asia get together and take over the world and, like, impose their inferior Asian values on the world. So the world, even after Pan-Mongolianism, as it's called, is overthrown, the world is weakened. There's kind of a place for the Antichrist to basically publish what is the greatest self-help book ever. So he becomes basically king of the world. He gets this weird Byzantine magician to like perform all these miracles. He basically establishes himself as the leader of the world church. And then it ends in pretty typical apocalyptic fashion, where a group of Christian dissidents goes off to the desert to await the apocalypse. There's the Battle of Armageddon, and he's defeated. And you can see absolutely the influence of Soloviev on Thiel. Thiel is very interested in conservative, anti-globalist, kind of racially encoded. He's very disinterested in any other apocalyptic tradition. Does not care about, you know, Islamic apocalyptic traditions, which I saw you talked about earlier on this series. Like, you know,
we're going to be talking a lot more about that.
It's a very rich tradition. Yeah. But what's interesting with Thiel is that, unlike Soloviev, Soloviev is very anti-technology. He feels like modern technology, specifically the radio and mass print media, is what's going to enable the rise of the Antichrist. Whereas Thiel, for him, it's fear of these things, fear of AI, fear of kind of technological oligarchs that will enable someone like Greta Thunberg to basically turn up. I know, every time I think that, I'm like, her? I don't think she's the Antichrist, but it's very interesting, because I think when we were first talking about this, you threw out the idea that Peter Thiel is kind of an anti-cultural apocalypse.
It's not countercultural, is it? Unless you want to call capitalist disruptors countercultural, but they're not. They're just what capitalism does, right?
Yes.
They are the system playing out just exactly the way it's supposed to. But anti-cultural, maybe, in the sense of, I mean, okay, every human, strictly speaking, everything humans do is culture, so you can't really have anti-culture.
Right.
But the total, well, first of all, the total illiteracy, the total lack of depth of knowledge. Like, if you're going to go public and, I don't know, go to the Vatican and talk about the apocalypse to a bunch of learned Jesuits or whatever, right? You'd think you'd want to have some chops. But he seems to be utterly without chops.
He hasn't got past his 19th or 20th century predecessors. He feels, because often what I find researching stuff about the Antichrist in media is someone will be like, oh, I cited Bernard McGinn. I've done my due diligence. Here's everything you need to know about the Antichrist. It feels very similar to that, except instead of a left-wing scholarly context, it's like a right-wing grifter.
Right. So that would be my next question. Do you think he actually believes any of this, or is it just very convenient for someone who's in a field, a technological field, that needs to expand really fast, take over the world really fast, build all manner of data centers, and not have any regulation, to just argue that your market competitor, or that people who might threaten your market share, are the Antichrist?
I mean, I don't really want to plunge into the mind of Peter Thiel and figure out what he really, like, believes, but I do feel like he is tapping into a tried and true 20th century conservative capitalist tradition of kind of using. Yeah, are you familiar with Hal Lindsey's The Late Great Planet Earth?
I know of it. It was a big 70s bestseller about how we're all doomed because of, well, no, because it was a Jesus one, wasn't it?
Yes, yeah. It's a Christian book about, yeah, very similar, about how basically like the Soviets and the Chinese are going to cause Armageddon, and how a new world order, like a single state, is going to be the Antichrist vehicle for kind of creating tyranny. And the thing is, like, people like Ronald Reagan really like Hal Lindsey. They kind of use this narrative of very cut and dry binary battle between good and evil to kind of promote thing, like, you know, Star Wars defense program. There's a wonderful book by Michael Lieb called Children of Ezekiel, which does a great job of talking about like the relationship between technology and apocalypse, and how apocalypse serves to, I'm going to use big words, but I'll translate them, concretize the ineffable, basically turn these things that we can't talk about, that are hard to talk about, or because we don't have a language for them, because they're new, because they're kind of traumatic in the way they just shake up our current world. Apocalypse puts that into language. Apocalypse becomes a great way of selling for the hegemony, because I definitely, one thing I do want to make clear is that apocalypse isn't always countercultural. Apocalypse can work really well for whoever's in power, because, yeah, it's a great way of selling disruption. And this is something that I feel like is interesting about Antichrist, because Christ, I feel like, in a lot of Apocalypse mirrors this, and even Peter Thiel's kind of characterization of the Antichrist mirrors this. Antichrist becomes a great way of thinking about how people in power say, oh, there's this scary thing that's coming in the future, so let me have power, let me do what I need to do to kind of consolidate my base, and then, you know, you'll be safe. And that's how Antichrist ends up, you know, becoming kind of this world leader, is through these promises of kind of stability and protection and safety. There's almost this anxiety about it in a lot of apocalypses. I think the figure of Antichrist is kind of used to think through. In the case of Peter Thiel, Antichrist is being purely used to say, no, there are bigger threats than climate change. There are bigger threats than AI. We need to be scared about these leftist dissidents and these philanthropist billionaires I don't like. He hates Bill Gates. He talks so much. He keeps saying, Bill Gates is not the Antichrist, but I really hate this guy, which I think is hilarious. And that's another thing, too, is The Guardian talks of, in their article about these lectures, talks about how, you know, Peter Thiel is very rambly and diffuse. He loves quoting the Bible, and he loves, like, telling, like, personal anecdotes. I feel like he's kind of like an outsider artist. It's kind of like he's unintentionally creating this really fascinating text, like, but there's no, going back to Burma, there's no knowledge of something higher. There's no historical knowledge or knowledge of, like, a deeper mystical tradition guiding it. So you get this kind of weird, kind of carnivalesque apocalypse. It's like a fun mirror version of Apocalypse. Yeah, I think that's what's interesting about Thiel, is he's kind of unintentionally creating this weird bricolage of a lot of 20th century conservative apocalypses.
Yeah, and maybe just because he is so on the spectrum that he doesn't get how weird it is, or how weird it seems to normies, maybe. Like, you all know what I'm talking about, right? Like, Greta Thunberg obviously could be the Antichrist. That makes sense. And his entire audience are going, what?
I did read that it's mostly, like, young white guys in their 20s and 30s, so maybe an audience that's a little more, but I'm sure there's,
So he could maybe actually have his finger on the pulse, exactly, you know? Like, he's just speaking to an audience that are just eating it up. Yes, Peter Thiel, tell me more.
I'm sure that they think that, I feel like he's good at making people feel like they get what he's saying, because, like, I read what he's saying, and I'm like, I don't get this. Like, this is very confusing to me as someone who's very interested in Apocalypse, very interested in this history of counterculture. It's like he's claiming to be both of these things, and because, like, familiar with them, I'm like, no, this is not my guy. This is, which again, kind of brings us back to this idea that, yeah, on the surface, Peter Thiel kind of seems like an Antichrist figure. He seems like a Sam Neill Final Conflict figure, or like even like Michael York in Megiddo, The Omega Code 2, which is like an even...
Which I have not seen.
Oh, it's so good. You gotta... Like, Michael York is just having so much fun being the Antichrist and just like striking people with lightning. And his brother, who's the president of the United States, of course, they have a big conflict. The U.S. has to team up with... And I'm quoting the movie here, the Chinese and the Latins, in order to defeat the UN, basically. And at the climax of this battle, Michael York just, like, rips off his human skin. He's just this CGI gargoyle that gets plunged into, like, hell. Yeah, that's kind of what Peter Thiel reminds me of. Since that movie came out, like, in the early 2000s, that is a vision of the Antichrist very much immersed the idea of the UN and global media and, like, all of that. But although it's very critical of those mechanisms that allow for the Antichrist to become possible, I think it's even critical in a way of kind of the use of computer technology to kind of replicate. I think, you know, Michael York turning into a CGI gargoyle is like film thinking about its inadequacies at representing reality. I'm like,
or they were just low budget.
I'm sure it's that, yeah. But I can dream. I can, But I think there's an interesting way in which that kind of constraint of it being this low-budget conservative project kind of speaks against itself. That's one thing I'm really interested in with Antichrist, is the way that even in these conservative apocalypses, the figure of Antichrist speaks out against the message or the... Like kind of what we were talking about with Peter Thiel and how his work becomes unintentionally fascinating. There's this way in which the figure of Antichrist in his lectures kind of cries out against him and kind of condemns the very system that he is supporting.
And maybe that goes back to the initial character building that John of Patmos did in the first place, because it's a very ambivalent figure, isn't it? It's the this figure that is admirable in the sense of any worldly, in any worldly yes. sense you care to name, but is on the wrong side simply for this one crucial flaw, which is that it's not really Jesus. It's not really the Christ. The real Christ is not about any of that worldly stuff. And so then you're in this position, which makes sense in a literary context, but the minute you put it into action in the world, it leads to all manner of fuckery, which is anything that's good in the worldly sense is trash, right? And that could, you know, if you think of some fundamentalist Christians today, for example, they're like, yeah, bring on the nuclear war, let's go, right?
Right, absolutely.
Which, in a historically concrete sense of people living their lives, is obviously a bad idea. But it's like, well, what are you on this Antichrist side? You don't want the nuclear war? You know? So it can, that's a very weird, conflicted character, conflicted literary trope. That's like, we have to embrace the destruction of everything, because the guy who's coming along saying, we need to preserve stuff and do good things and make the world work well, that's the Antichrist. So we have to reject that guy. So that's a troubled legacy.
Absolutely. No, like I'm here. That's something I'm like still kind of troubled by, because as I've been working on this when I originally started this chapter, I was kind of like, okay, so Antichrist is kind of the way that counterculture co-opts apocalypse. It's kind of how apocalypse becomes its own thing in counterculture. And then I realized there's a problem with Antichrist in all of it. Iterations, as you said, it's all about surface, it's all about aesthetics and theater. There's this one guy I really like, John Parker, who talks about how Antichrist is a way for the early Christian fathers, like Origen, to, you know, think about Christianity's debt to Greek theater, especially in the Gospels. As I've been reading more about the Antichrist, I'm like, the problem with Antichrist is that there's no hope for the future. There's no hope for making things better. Antichrist, any reforms that are not done with any look towards the future. And I think that again kind of lends itself well to like thinking about why a lot of apocalypses just end with the death of the Antichrist. So I feel like there are aspects of the Antichrist that are kind of important for countercultural authors to kind of take on themselves. One thing I argue is that Antichrist in a lot of these modern texts becomes, again, part of kind of how someone like William Blake thinks about his artistry. Or it becomes about how he structures like a sprawling 100-page... As we talked about, those illuminated manuscripts are very intricate and very hard to put together. Something like Jerusalem is like an overwhelming text to read in any form. And like there's a way in which Antichrist becomes a way... The production of an Antichrist, the production of a second Christ who's not like the first Christ... By the end of Jerusalem is a huge part of what I think a lot of countercultural apocalypses. For Blake, it's this view of forgiveness. It's this view of, and a lot of people say, oh, that's Blake becoming like a bitter, discouraged Christian in his old age. But for me, when you read in the final plates of Jerusalem about Christ like shooting arrows of love, and like there's just like all this chaotic, very noisy imagery, and like everything just kind of abruptly comes into this state of everything kind of just being this mess of love and forgiveness. I think you need something like that. You need to combine that with this kind of view of an absolutely fucked up present in order to produce something that's radical, in order to produce something where you can look back at the past and be, maybe there is something we can take away from this. Maybe we don't need a nuclear war to just wipe everything out. Maybe there are things that are important to repurpose, like Blake is doing with Christian mythology. There are things that are important to kind of retool so that they speak to these more egalitarian utopian values.
Like Blake is doing with the products of the Industrial Revolution that he is decrying, right? He's
absolutely.
Like, he's against the dark satanic mills, but he still needs those copper plates
yes.
to do his engravings on, and he needs the presses, he needs all this sort of early 19th century technology, late 18th century printing technology. But he's going to use it for prophetic revelation.
Yeah, and I think that even like the fact that he needed funding from a rich dude speaks to that as well. Like, Blake's a great example of how even with those kind of, you could say like concessions, like the reality of his situation, he's still this like very visionary, uncompromising artist who, like, clearly, based on the references to his work in the 20th and 21st century, still speaks to our present moment. That's what I find fascinating about even reading a lot of this early apocalyptic stuff, like Hippolytus or a Pseudo-Methodius. It's like, it still speaks to a lot of anxieties and concerns we have about disruption, about what it means to be living in the midst of a history of... For me, I kind of subscribe to the view that history experiences like this traumatic succession of violent acts. And what does that mean to live in the middle of that and to make sense of that? I think that's a question Apocalypse has been asking since the beginning of this Christian mystical tradition.
Yeah, or maybe even earlier.
Yeah, I know that's a little controversial. Like, I know people love arguing, when did Apocalypse begin? Like, where were its forebears?
I'm going to say 1 Enoch, 3rd century BCE, written by Jews who were in a parlous situation vis-a-vis the Hellenistic rulers of their land. So they were certainly going through it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's part of the background anyway. And that's our first apocalypse that we can say is 100... It ticks all the boxes. Unless you want to use Plato's Republic, the myth of Ur in Plato's Republic, as an example of apocalypse. It does tick all the boxes.
That is true. I do know David Hanson, the biblical scholar, loves to be like, oh, apocalypse immediately began after the destruction of the temple. It was unfortunately one of the first things I read reading Apocalypse. And I was like, this is pretty convincing. I like this. I do like the idea of Plato's Republic being an apocalypse. It makes sense to me.
Well, so listeners who are not familiar with this whole discussion of the genre of apocalypse will want to check out, I think, this very seminal, at least in biblical studies, very seminal issue of the journal Semeia, 1970-something, I'm going to say 77.
But I think that's right, yeah.
Edited by John Collins, whom we've discussed apocalyptic with on the Schwepp. And he attempts to make a typology, and the typology has been very influential. Whether you want to subscribe to it or not is another thing, but it's certainly a useful go-to sort of standard or canon of what we mean when we talk about apocalypse as a genre. And it's revealed knowledge in a literary form, in the form of a revelation, usually with a guide figure, be it an angel, be it a something, be it a daimon, whatever. Very often taking the form of an ascent journey, but not always. Sometimes, of course, being a descent, a katabasis journey, but a journey of some kind, consisting of revelations, and there's a guide. That's your basic apocalyptic genre description. And it doesn't do to get too obsessed with ticking those boxes, but at least having those boxes to tick means you can be roughly discussing the same genre.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean? And in that sense, the myth of Ur in Plato's Republic is just fully apocalyptic.
Yeah, no, like, as you were describing, I was like, yeah, that checks a lot of those boxes. I do have some frustrations with Collins, because I think, as you said, his idea of what apocalypse is, it's a very useful definition for getting you in the general ballpark, but as some of his critics have said, like, no apocalypse checks every single one of his boxes. My thesis advisor, the person who kind of, like, got me interested in apocalypse and, like, literary theory, yeah, I don't think he's the biggest fan of Collins ever, so I think I've inherited that a little, but, like, definitely, like, a useful introduction to... I think Collins is a great way of getting your bearings with, like, apocalypse.
If you are going to talk about apocalypse in as a genre, you have to mean something.
Absolutely.
And... But it's clearly going to be a family resemblance model. It's not going to be, you're either in or you're out. It's going to be a kind of vague, like if you get 3 out of 5, you're probably in that sort of family resemblance approach. Which
Absolutely.
Is probably the best we can do with a lot of literary genres.
The working definition I've kind of fallen on, like, it's kind of a way of thinking about the ending of an old order and the beginning of a new one while the old order is still hanging
with
on.
Us, right?
Yeah, because, like, as you said, I don't think, like, I think a lot of critics of apocalypse, and to be fair, I think a lot of modern apocalyptic writers, like we were talking about in context with Peter Thiel, do adopt this version of apocalypse that's very dispensationalist, very just like, here's this predetermined path towards this, like, battle between clear-cut good and evil, and that's it. And then there's the end of history. I don't think that's what's happening. I think Antichrist is all about kind of this uncanniness, this way that the things we thought we put aside in the past, the barbarism of the past, like, it still pops up. It's still here. Like, it's still lingering with us. Yeah. So, like, in the same way that kind of a rich prophetic tradition is still lingering with us. I think those are the two things someone writing any apocalypse, especially a countercultural one, has to bring together, are these two lingering traditions. One that's looking towards the future and one that's aware of history. One that's aware of kind of how we got here.
I wonder if there isn't something you need to throw in about the purported status of the revealed knowledge. Because
mm-hmm.
if we're talking about writing about the future in the present, writing about a future that transcends the current shit show, mm-hmm. whilst in the midst of the current shit show,
yes,
a lot of utopian literature is going to fit into this. A lot of like science fiction is going to fit into this, which doesn't claim to be revealed knowledge from the angels or God, right?
Definitely.
Well, a lot of our apocalyptic does claim to be revealed knowledge of divine secrets.
Absolutely. And that's, so, yes, sorry, what were you?
It's that kind of epistemological, the big truth claim is maybe part of it as well.
Absolutely. I think that's definitely something I'm talking about in the next chapter I'm working on, where I'm talking about how, like, kind of drawing on the Merkaba vision and, like, this idea of the apocalyptic author kind of inhabited, you know, like Ezekiel, when he sees these wheels, he describes these figures going to and fro. I kind of argue that part of this revealed knowledge is this process of moving back and forth, the oscillation. Like, that's another of my, like, that's another connection to kind of my interest in sampling and, like, noise. The way in which apocalypse becomes about creating what sounds like noise, but heard with the right ears, read with the right eyes, becomes kind of this new music, becomes this kind of new way of thinking.
Krista Muratore, thank you so much for exploring the territory that you're working on with your PhD research, and bringing some of the stuff we've covered in the, you know, sort of early building of the Christian tradition on the Schwepp, the sort of esoteric currents within millenarianism, within apocalyptic thinking, into the early modern and even the bleeding edge modern era.
Mm-hmm.
And stay esoteric.
Thank you. Yeah, we'll try it. We'll have fun talking about this, so thank you.